Welcome to Us with me, Dr. Crystal Lee Crane, where we have critical conversations on the challenges of our time. Come dig in with me and my guests as we tackle critical discussions about the hard lines we draw regarding morality, inequality, and the spirit. Listen while we focus on the intersections of truth and justice as we learn how to coexist, pushing our social transformation to the next level. Let's get ready to be inspired and engage in questions about humanity and believe in a different world. As we look forward to listeners who want to experience media from an intersectional and healing justice perspective, Us with Dr. Crystal Lee starts now. Hello, everyone. I'm Dr. Crystal Lee Crane, and you're listening to Us on Transformation Talk Radio. Stay with us for the next hour as we talk with human rights activists, some of which participated in the International Observation Mission in the Philippines. This is part two, featuring the importance of international solidarity. As reported in the IOM Interim Report, the International Observer Mission, sponsored by ICHRP, found that the May 9th Philippine national elections were marred by a higher level of failure of the electronic voting systems more than ever before, along with a higher level of blatant vote buying and disturbing levels of red tagging and violence. Today, we have National Coordinator of ICHRP, Drew Miller, and ICHRP members Layla McFoy and Mac Miller. Mac, you recently published an article in Rappler entitled, "I Was Called a Terrorist Supporter While Observing the Philippines Elections," describing your experience with state repression while on the IOM in the Philippines. Can you tell us a little bit about what happened?
Yeah, definitely. As we were preparing for the International Observers Mission, we were in the National Capital Region. We were doing our orientations, kind of waiting for everyone to fly in, meeting with the national management team and really prepping our group that was intending to fly down to Mindanao. So it was like a few days in NCR. And so then we flew down to Mindanao. We were starting to really settle into our area. We were staying at a place that was like hosting us for those 2 weeks. And about a day in, our local host got contacted by the national management team back in NCR. And they let us know that they found posters around the hotel that we were staying at in NCR with my face on it, my passport picture, my full government name, so my first, middle, and last name, and calling me a terrorist supporter. And they were associating me with the CPP, NPA, NDF. There's a huge X on my face, and it said at the bottom, "Get out now." And so that was definitely very alarming for us, especially as we're kind of like just kicking off the IOM and really ready to like hit the ground and interact with communities. And it was definitely very sobering to suddenly experience right off the bat a red tagging that was indicative of the state apparatus and intelligence listening to us and knowing our whereabouts and potentially even collusion with the Immigration Bureau and getting my passport photo. And so, so the national management team, they found posters around the hotel that we were staying at. And it was definitely a very stark way to start off the IOM, that's for sure.
Yes, it was. I'm in full transparency. I think I mentioned this in part one, but I was also there in the Philippines with this team with a couple folks that we'll be hearing from today. So can you all tell me what exactly is red tagging so our listeners have a deeper understanding?
Yeah, so red tagging, it refers to essentially any attempt to portray an individual or an organization as communist or supporter of the communist opposition forces in the ongoing Filipino Civil War. So red tagging can take multiple forms. Right, it can look like explicit posters, like the ones Mac was targeted by. Those posters are also sometimes called tarpaulins that make these kinds of claims. It can also look like online harassment or statements in media made by government officials or government allies. And unfortunately, the most deadly form of red tagging is extrajudicial killing, which is unfortunately a really common reality for activists and organizers, peasants and their allies around the Philippines. There was actually another example of red tagging directly connected to the IOM earlier in the election season. An individual named Joe Yosfacher, who was an IOM delegate, was faced with a similar tarpaulin harassment attack posted outside of his hotel. And he was even also experienced a small group of fascist supporters gathering outside of the place where he was staying to harass him. So this has been a repeated tactic of harassment that the IOM has faced. And it's just one small example of what harassment and red tagging can look like in the Philippines. So the big picture, I guess, is that essentially red tagging is a form of deadly harassment that's intended to intimidate members of the public and silence or eliminate legitimate criticism of the government and legitimate political activity.
Yeah, so I'm hearing it's these posters, it's actual physical intimidation. Is it happening by state actors, non-state actors?
Yeah, so I think that's a very important aspect of red tagging to really expand upon. I think for the backdrop of red tagging that we really have to understand is that in the Philippines, there is an active ongoing civil war, on one side being now the Marcos Duterte tandem as the new presidential heads. And then on the other side is the CPP, NPA, NDF. And so when people are being red tagged, they're being associated with one side of the civil war that's going. And that can, you know, that's inherently a very dangerous thing to do, to connect people who are disengaged in civil political organizing and legal organizing to be connected with and accused of being associated with an armed group and a group of people who are being forced to take up arms and whatnot. And so it's a very heavy thing to be red tagged, for sure. And I think to provide that context is quite important, because to be called a communist in the Philippines is much different than to be called a communist in the US, for sure. But going back to what you're saying, is it carried out by state actors or non-state actors? It's very intentionally blurred. It's not such a black and white affair per se. And the state really utilizes non-state actors in quotes to carry out so much of the red tagging and repression. Like, we'll never truly know who it was exactly that put up tarpaulins of both me and Joe, who are on the IOM, and accused us of association with the CPP. And that's very intentional. And similarly, many extrajudicial killings that are carried out by people who are often unidentified or masked. And so we will never really know if we can associate them with the state or non-state actors, but that's very intentional because it gives the state a hook. They're no longer responsible for these so many targeted political killings, because they don't have to be if there's not an open and direct association with the state and the state repression that's being carried out. And so I think to kind of detail that more, we really see a development in the red tagging and the state repression that's occurring in the Philippines within the past few years, particularly in 2018 under Duterte. The National Task Force to End Local Communist Armed Conflict was established, which really signified a massive development in the repression in the Philippines. This is essentially an attempt to mobilize the entire state apparatus to end ongoing civil war that threatens the current government in power, and really is used as like an information center for all the various governmental agencies to then be employed to carry out this form of state repression. And then we saw an even greater development in their oppression when the anti-terror law in the summer of 2020 was enacted, which basically criminalized any form of criticism against the government and really employed some really drastic and horrendous forms of repression, including really unlawful times of detention without trial and just a real genuine impunity for any state actors or non-state actors to engage in red tagging and repression. And so we're really seeing in the past few years under Duterte and now under Marcos and Duterte, a significant development in this kind of state repression.
Yes, I am concerned specifically around Mindanao, and that's somewhere that you traveled to for the election observation trip. Can you talk a little bit about the state repression that's happening specifically in the Mindanao district?
Sure, I can jump in here. And one thing I'll add, you know, following what Mac was sharing earlier, is that the NTF LCAC and the anti-terror law kind of give cover and give legitimacy from the state to all forms of harassment and against criticism of the state, right? So I think part of, and Matt kind of mentioned this, but I wanted to highlight it, that part of the function of those bodies and those of that legislation is to give cover for and to muddy the water so that it can become so that the full, you know what, can we just cut this because I feel like I'm not making sense anymore. I'm gonna jump straight into the Mindanao part. So right. So I'll talk about what we experienced in Mindanao. We observed a high level of militarization in Mindanao during our observation trip. During just like a 4-hour drive that I think we took, we passed through almost 20 or so checkpoints. And these were checkpoints both staffed by the AFP and the PNP, so the Armed Forces of the Philippines and the Philippine National Police. They were labeled as quote unquote COMELEC checkpoints. So COMELEC stands for the Commission on Elections. That's the body that manages the elections in the Philippines. But they were staffed by armed men in fatigues, creating this kind of incredibly militarized atmosphere. Similarly, when we were out on election day and visiting polls, we saw that the polling sites were also staffed by armed men carrying, you know, large military grade weapons. They were, I think in most cases, PNP, but functionally indistinguishable from the AFP. And I do want to assert that the presence of the military itself is a form of repression, right? These are heavily armed individuals, right, who have, you know, the backing of the state to engage in violence, who have a history of engaging in violence against members of the public and members of communities. So in and of itself, the presence of the military is a form of state repression. And we have to consider it as such. And I want to give a little bit of context as to why military presence is so high in Mindanao. There's kind of two reasons that I want to highlight. One is that there's a really rich history of indigenous resistance and indigenous struggle in the Philippines. In Mindanao. At the time, you know, a little bit more than 100 years ago, when the U.S. assumed colonial control over the Philippines from Spain, the people of Mindanao were not colonized in the same way that peoples of other islands had been colonized by the Spanish. So the colonial history of Mindanao is much newer, much fresher, and I think arguably ongoing in a different way there. So over the past 40 years, indigenous people, including the Moro, who are an Islamized indigenous group, and the Lumad, who are non-Islamized, have been engaged in various forms of struggle to assert their own autonomy within the context of the Philippines and within Mindanao. So particularly the Moro, and we were in Mindanao, we were in an area called the Barn. Actually, pause. Am I allowed to say this? Yes.
Yeah, I think it's okay.
So in Mindanao, we are in an area called the Barm, which stands for the Bangsamoro Autonomous Region of Muslim Mindanao, which is a kind of district that is majority Moro. Was created kind of as the result of a long history of Moro struggle for autonomy in the area. But what that history and an ongoing condition of colonization in Mindanao means is that there is, you know, an active effort by the Philippine government and by the armed forces of the Philippines to continue taking land from indigenous people to disrupt the, you know, traditional social structures there. And that, you know, those actions are enforced by the presence of the military.
Thank you for that. You know, one thing that I remember when we were driving from each of our locations, it was about every 2 to 5 miles that, that there was a militarized checkpoint. And I stopped counting after 17. I remember like writing tally notes in my notebook being like, okay, after, you know, after 17. And I know there was more than that. Had to be at least 24, if not more, within a 4-hour trip, right? I want to bring Drew into the conversation, who is the national coordinator of iChirp. In the last days, weeks, and months of the outgoing Duterte regime, there was ramped up state repression against peasants, labor organizers, and critics. And what did that look like from your perspective, Drew?
Yeah, so there was a few aspects of that that were very much in line with the policies of the previous Duterte administration and what it had been the past 5 years, but they had been heightened. I will mention a few things. So one is that there was a major arrest. It was actually the largest mass arrest under the Duterte administration of 97 people. So they're known as the Tinang 97. So they're in Tarlac in northern Philippines. This arrest happened just in the remaining weeks of the regime. There were farmers who were owed land based off of this land reform program that was actually agreed upon in the 90s. And if you look throughout history, there's actually been this land reform program where many people have been promised land and it's never been given to them properly. And that's a problem that goes beyond just this group of people to all over the Philippines. They were doing what's called a bungkalan. Bungkalan is a practice in which farmers will start using the land that they're owed, and they'll start planting and working on it or gather on it. It's a legal practice in the Philippines, but it's actually something that faces a lot of military repression, even up to the point of killings. So there have been killings for this practice by farmers under Duterte. Most famously, I believe, the Sagay 9, which is a case where they were massacred. So there's this large group of farmers doing this, and they're all arrested. So then if you look at what are the citations of why did this happen, is actually they were charged with malicious mischief was one of the charges, which was a new term for me. There was that along with some other charges like illegal assembly. So they were grouped in there. The charges have now been dropped, but there was this major arrest due to the fact saying there. Yeah. So it's due to the farming of saying, oh, it's illegal that you're doing this. It's an illegal assembly and malicious mischief. You can judge for yourself what that means. I will say that, you know, it's actually in line with the previous practices. That's actually the Duterte government, which is the ones who have malicious mischief, or that should be the charge for them, really. So that was one incident. Another major incident is that there's been a new firewall that's been attempted to put up in the Philippines, where the National Security Council, along with the Anti-Terrorism Council, made a list of, I believe, 20 websites of organizations in the Philippines, as well as news outlets that are being tagged, red tagged, associated with the Communist Party, and said they have to shut down because of that. And so that's also in line with the previous shutdown of ABS-CBN, which is a major news outlet in the Philippines, as well as the attacks on Rappler, most famously, and Maria Ressa, who won the Nobel Peace Prize. And so there's been an intense crackdown both on media and farmers and resistance. So how do we analyze that? There's one, the piece of Duterte is just using the end of his term to wreak the most havoc and worst repression that he can. We know his daughter is still in the vice presidency, and so he still has a maintenance on power. But surely also it's something that the Marcos administration, he knows, is not going to take accountability on it, because the Marcos administration that was elected is actually the one that, you know, they're trying to cover up all the crimes of his father, Ferdinand Marcos Sr., against the people. And so Duterte, along with the Marcos, are positioning themselves in a way where they can commit whatever crimes and then rewrite history and say it was the best time in the Philippines when they're in power.
And I would just add one brief additional point regarding the Tinang 97 that Drew mentioned, which is that I read actually an article in the Philippine News Agency. So, right, this is the government-funded news outlet sharing the government's perspective, that was claiming that the purpose of these arrests and that the purpose of the Bungkalan that the farmers were engaged in was to somehow disrupt Marcos Jr.'s ability to take on the presidency. So it's right there out in the open that the government sees these kinds of collective actions as a threat to its power, and also sees the repression and the arrests that they have undertaken as central to the elections process and to the transfer of power from Duterte to Marcos. So I think it's important to understand, right, that it's out there, right out there in the open, that these kinds of actions taken against, you know, peasant farmers and their allies are a central piece of how the outgoing and the new Philippine regimes are centralizing their power and consolidating it. And they understand that kind of repression as essential to their ability to retain power.
Thank you for that. I think it's super important because many of our listeners, I was just actually looking, I think 85% of the folks listening to this are in the United States, and then I have other folks in other countries and such. But these countries are mostly Western countries, folks listening from Western countries, where we are looking at it from the left perspective, we say we live in a police state. There's levels to this, right? And so we can't, unless you see it firsthand. And, you know, for me, I've been all over the world. I've seen it in the Philippines. I've seen it in Indonesia. I've seen it, you know, in the Republic of Marshall Islands. I've seen it in different places around the world, but we can't visualize it if we haven't seen it before. And so I'm really interested. I want to hear from Drew again a little bit about what are some of the things that Duterte is being investigated about, and if you could give some description to what this looks like for folks, similarly to what Layla was doing.
Yeah, so there's been a couple of different investigations that have happened during the time of Duterte. I can speak to a few. One is there's the ICC, International Criminal Court investigation. There's also the a report from the UN Human Rights Council, which has come out a few years ago. And then also a recent project, if I can share, of ICHRP, which is actually Investigate PH. And that has several reports that have come out. And these are just a few of the major ones that have come out alongside of many human rights reports on the Philippines. So just to start with the International Criminal Court. So Duterte is most famous in international news about his war on drugs. So from the beginning of his term, Duterte promised that if he found someone who did drugs, that his police had open fire. They could just shoot to kill drug dealers. And so that was his solution to the problems of drugs in the Philippines. And so with this war on drugs that's happened, in which Duterte had said, to the extent where he said, oh, Hitler killed 6 million Jews, so how many drug killers can I kill? So that's like to the level where he's openly comparing himself to Hitler. And so you can see the not just the need for investigation, actually, but for prosecution and accountability. But in terms of the investigations that are happening, the ICC has been working on one since 2016 is where it first started servicing, around the time Duterte was bringing up these issues. One thing to know is that the drug killings, they've been officially reported from the government as the Philippines as 6,000 people who have been killed over the course of this drug war. However, these numbers are actually from years ago, where for years they've been saying it was 6,000. And even while the government of the Philippines and the police were reporting 6,000, the human rights groups internationally, against going back several years ago, were already reporting 30,000. So the numbers could be far beyond that in terms of the killings related to the drug war. And so there's been back and forth. The Philippines actually withdrew their membership from the International Criminal Court. Duterte did that really in a move to avoid this point of accountability. But the case is reopening now. So it's one thing of there's been, you know, speculation that part of the role of having a close alliance with the Marcoses and also Sarah Duterte, Rodrigo Duterte's daughter in the vice presidency, is also partially to protect them from international investigations and prosecution. Even now we're seeing that the U.S. has basically overlooked a crime of Marcos, where Marcos Jr. has a contempt case in the U.S. worth millions of dollars, but the U.S. has said, well, he's a head of state, and so we'll let him in, despite this contempt of court case that has major money tied to it. So there are attempts to avoid accountability through like the head of state position. So then moving on, the other ones I mentioned is the UN Human Rights Council. There hasn't been a full investigation, but there was a report that came out from Michelle Bachelet, who's the UN Human Rights Council High Commissioner from Chile. And it's a very good report. From it, you know, she mentioned like the issue of red tagging, the killings, the repression that had been mentioned before that Mac and Layla had talked about. Additionally, I think some of the like issues with this is that there hasn't been strong follow-up from the UN. There has been like a ruling of providing technical assistance to the Philippine government, but in terms of accountability, it's very has not provided a lot to the Philippine government, as we see like these have continued no issues. The last thing I'll mention is Investigate PH, or Investigate Philippines, which is an independent international investigation put on by people across the globe over the past couple of years. This report was very comprehensive in terms of covering the human rights issues in the Philippines, not just the issue of individual human rights, but collective human rights of the whole Filipino people. And it really puts into context also the historical situation of the Philippines, of the long history of colonization by the Spanish in the US, and how that's formed the society and how it functions today. So in going through the final report, after going through all these interviews of victims and experts on the ground in the Philippines that were conducted, it covers very comprehensively different issues. So it covers Duterte's policy of like privatization, trade liberalization, and labor deregulation that have made it harder on working people in the Philippines. It highlights how he's slashed social services, but increased resources for militarization, especially during the time of COVID-19, where the military, who we mentioned, were creating all these checkpoints. It talks about the creation of the National Task Force to End Local Communist Armed Conflict and how that's been related to repression of labor organizing. It talks about repression of homophobic and sexual violence perpetrated by armed forces, domestic abuse, as well as the persecution of women, girls, and LGBTQ people. And then overall, I think it also talks about the issue of indigenous people, the Moro and the Muslim communities, but also beyond that. And finally, really hits it on the head in terms of, again, noting that the policies of the Duterte administration have been against the self-determination of the Filipino people, that as a whole, the way he has handled the economic situation, the military situation, has been against the lives of everyday people in their ability to live good lives. And I think just like if you connected back to the International Observer's Mission and the report that ITRIP released, you know, for ITRIP's end, we didn't want to just look at the voting as itself, as its own right. So of course, we also support individual right to vote. But then when we analyze what happened with this election, last elections period, you can have your right to vote, but if you don't have access to your ancestral lands as indigenous people, or if you live in a city that's been completely bombed out by the military, or if you're being intimidated by military, then you really don't have your basic rights or ability to self-determine who the president would be. And so that's our perspective on it.
That's so great. Thank you so much, Drew, for kind of fleshing that out for us, because ITRIP's role and then all the things ITRIP has done and then the pieces, how it connects, I think it's important for listeners to get. And so for folks who are listening, we'll be sure to have links to all this on the podcast page so you can definitely get more information. I want to know what you all anticipate in terms of state repression under the recently inaugurated Marcos Duterte tandem. And has there been any specific changes made already from what, you know, I'll call Papa Duterte was doing to what's going to be happening moving forward? What do we anticipate?
Yeah, I think we can definitely, as we're already seeing with the end of the current Duterte administration's a really significant development. It's quite common for at the end of presidencies for repression to increase, but this is a very particular presidency, as we know, is essentially the consolidation of the fascist forces under the new regime. And so we can really connect those two quite clearly, even with the Tinong 97 and the increase in red tagging. And even recently, there's actually been red tagging, or what we call terror tagging, of overseas National Democratic activists too. And so National Democratic organizations like Anak Bayan and Gabriela and Migrante are organizing in Filipino communities in the diaspora, and particularly in the US. And within the past year or so, we've actually seen red tagging occur against the overseas National Democratic mass organizations too. And so in the communities that they're going around organizing in, people are going around and handing out flyers and calling them terrorists and trying to isolate them from their communities that they're serving as well. And so we really want to make effort to connect that overseas repression as part of the larger project to repress the Filipino people from exercising their right to organizing and democratic processes. And we really recognize that as part of the consulates being outposts for the PNP, and really using them not just as consulates in the traditional sense, but also as eyes of the Philippine state in attempting to suppress its ever-growing diaspora because of the worsening economic conditions. And so that's kind of just the beginning of it, but we really can expect a pretty significant increase in repression under Marcos. Even when we were interviewing various organizers on the ground in Mindanao, it was pretty clear across the board that everyone is really expecting to see an increase in violence and repression and criminalization of people exercising their rights to organize and engage in various forms of democratic processes and struggles. I think one thing worth connecting is that under the last Marcos regime, in which we saw horrendous martial law and, you know, horrendous amounts of extrajudicial killings and suppression, we also witnessed a really significant development of overseas repression too. And so at one point in the Marcos regime, there was assassination of anti-dictatorship activists and labor leaders, Silmé Domingo and Jean Biernes. And so it was a very significant and historic moment in the repression, in the sense that actual assassinations are being carried out of overseas organizers. And so if that indicates anything as to what the new Marcos administration will engage in, we definitely have to be prepared to wage campaigns and stand in solidarity with those organizing for national democracy in the Philippines and organizing for a sovereign and liberated Philippines.
Thank you so much for that. I think it's super important for folks who are listening to understand, you know, what the role the United States has in the Philippines and kind of what that looks like. And so I know the U.S. has had a longstanding military and security sector relationship with the Philippines. How has that enabled and supported acts of state repression?
Yeah, I can jump in here. And Mac and Drew, feel free to chime in as well. As we've kind of been discussing, right, the history of U.S. military presence in the Philippines goes back more than 100 years to the beginning of the colonial relationship, which I think, again, is important to understand as kind of the foundation upon which all of the, you know, subsequent history has built upon. Currently, there are U.S. Members of the U.S. military who are allowed to be stationed for, you know, periods of time in the Philippines under an agreement called the Visiting Forces Agreement, which, you know, has been in place more or less since the late 90s. And what those soldiers do is engage in joint drills with the Philippine, the Armed Forces of the Philippines, provide strategic training. There's also the provision of military aid, both in the form of money and also weapons, and then additionally arms sales. That's happening to the tune of hundreds of millions of dollars each year from the US to the Philippines in military aid in particular. This is a really shocking statistic. Between 2015 and 2021, the US sent more than $1 billion in military aid to the Philippines. So, right, it's an enormous amount of support that's going from, in terms of military aid, that's going from the US to the Philippines. And the Philippines is actually the largest recipient of US military assistance in the Indo-Pacific region. So that's kind of the context for the relationship between the US military and the Armed Forces of the Philippines and the Philippine government. We can see that relationship has enabled and supported acts of state repression in a number of ways. So one particular example is in 2017, a city in the Barm, in the Muslim region of Mindanao, called Marawi City, was the target of a 5-month bombing campaign, which devastated the community, gutted the town center, and has caused thousands of internally displaced people who still have not been able to return to their homes. And we can see that there are reports that, right, that siege, which was conducted by the Armed Forces of the Philippines, was supported by US weapons, which we know come in the form of arms sales and direct military aid. and then also was supported by strategy from U.S. actors. So that's just one really specific example of a way that state violence and state repression are carried out in the Philippines and in Mindanao in particular, supported by U.S. military aid and joint strategy.
That's a really important piece for me about why I've been involved with ICHRP since 2017 and what got me kind of, you know, rallied up around it was, wait, we're paying for this? I'm like, no, like not on my watch. And I'm not going to pay for other, you know, brown people around the world to be killed. And I don't think it's right. So can folks talk a little bit about what the Philippines Human Rights Act is and how, you know, important it is for us as Americans, taxpaying citizens and taxpaying residents who live here, who are actually contributing to this. What is the Philippines Human Rights Act?
Yeah, definitely. So the Philippine Human Rights Act is currently a piece of legislation that's taken on very much so by the grassroots organizations throughout the US who are both organizing for the Philippines and organizing in solidarity of the Philippines. And it seeks to cut all US military aid to the Philippine police and military until certain conditions are met, which are oriented around human rights and understanding the protection of people. And so it has been a long going piece of legislation that we've been fighting for a very long time. And it's exactly what you said as well. This is, you know, this is part of our democratic process, because as working people who are contributing these tax dollars, we don't want our tax dollars going to violence and human rights violations and extrajudicial killings overseas in the Philippines, but we want it to be funding education and healthcare and resources in our own communities. And so we are taking the democratic process to really fight for the Philippine Human Rights Act and really, you know, stop the US's contribution to the militarization and the human rights violations in the Philippines. And so it's been ongoing for quite some time, and we are really building a mass movement around it and really want everyone who is able to contribute to it and contribute their part to it, so that we can see a day in which the US is no longer funding fascism in the Philippines.
Or fascism here.
Yeah.
Right. Exactly. And a bit like this is, you know, there's a wave, I think, globally, and has been coming in this wave of fascism, just kind of getting a resurgence, I would say in the past decade and a half, but definitely we can see it so clearly now here in the United States and here and all over the world. And so I wonder who can speak to a little bit about, you know, folks talking about the consequences if the United States decides to hold the Philippines accountable to human rights violations, right? And takes money away until certain conditions have been made. Who can speak to that a little bit, and what are the consequences or potential consequences to that? Drew?
Sorry, actually, can you repeat the question one more time? Because I was actually chatting with Maria.
So I'm wondering if you could speak to some of the consequences that would happen if the US decides to step out. You know, there's talks about, you know, maybe China or Russia or, you know, things of that nature. Can you speak to that a little bit?
Yeah, so I think we have to ground it in the whole view, the US view of the Asia Pacific region, and particularly the Biden administration's recent response. You know, we can go back to, a very long time ago. If historically, the Philippines in the US, if you look back, there's, you know, when the US was actively colonizing the Philippines and had troops on the ground there, there's also all these graphics made where they're saying the Philippines is a stepping stone to China. And then you saw all of those resources and labor being depicted in these comics, which were also very racist. My reason of saying that is the US has for a long time and continues to view China as competition in terms of world power. Of course, it's morphed with the changes in society in China from the 1900s until now. But for the US to maintain its role in Asia Pacific, knowing it's also not just China there, it's Korea, Japan, where there's also been US interests, which I guess you could say is really all around the globe and not just Asia Pacific. But all that to say, the US has continued to show that it wants military and economic dominance in Asia Pacific region. So under Obama, there was a pivot to Asia. Under Trump, you know, there was a very adversarial position towards China in his rhetoric. And now towards Biden, they've really pushed the deepening militarization of the Asia Pacific region. So I give all that context to say, the US government, based off their view of that region, is scared to give up the military positioning that they have in the Philippines. And so that's the way they look at it. How I look at it is, if we actually want genuine peace, and also if the US respects the self-determination of other countries, then the US should not be there. Like, heightening the military presence in the Philippines and continuing that aid towards this regime is not actually going to lend itself towards peace. It's going to lend itself towards more war. So if the US is really having the stance of like human rights and democracy, it should actually demilitarize the region, the Asia Pacific region. And I think that would be a very positive step. And while it's true that, yeah, maybe Russia or China would then play a deeper role in wanting to provide military support to the Philippines, it doesn't make it right for the US to participate in the militarization of that region and the support for human rights violations. It cannot justify it.
Yeah, yes. It's like saying we're gonna, keep this peace just in case somebody else decides to do something else with it, right? It makes me think about Guam. It makes me think about the Marshall Islands, places I've been where, there is strategic military, they say, quote unquote, reasons for these things. I know that, I believe Layla and Mac had a couple things to add before we close out this conversation.
Yeah, I just wanted to add one brief point about the importance of the PHRA and exactly why it's necessary and essential to be directing our energy towards removing funding from the Philippine military. And I think it's what the PHRA does and what I think we have to do is assert that, human rights violations are being caused by the Philippine government and by the armed forces of the Philippines and other state actors. And if we think back to the beginning part of our conversation where we were talking about red tagging and the NTF-LCAC, the National Task Force to End Local Communist Armed Conflict, the function and the result of those practices and those organizations is, as Mac was mentioning, to create a sense of confusion about exactly who is causing extrajudicial killings, about who is engaging in harassment, and who is who is to blame, right, for the types of intimidation and human rights abuses that are being faced by the Filipino people. But it's important for us to see through that and to understand that government organizations like the NTF-LCAC are at the root of the human rights abuses. The AFP is at the root of human rights abuses, and that we actually have a mechanism in the US to intervene by limiting military funding for those state organs, state apparatuses. And it's important for us to remain clear that no, it's not, unnamed, unknown actors who are engaging in these human rights abuses. It's known actors, it's the state, and we have to stay firm on that.
Thank you for that. And Mac?
Yeah, I think that's like a great point to lead off of that. And I think something to really highlight and honor is the analysis that the National Democratic Movement of the Philippines puts forth, which is why it experiences so much suppression from the state, is that it understands that US imperialism is the number one contribution to the violations and the worsening conditions in the Philippines. And it recognizes the three basic problems of the Philippines to be US imperialism, feudalism, and bureaucrat capitalism. And so when we're looking at all these human rights violations and extrajudicial killings and repression going on, it's really important to think it through the analysis of the on-the-ground people's movement in the Philippines that are really at the heart of this, fighting against it and really struggling for a better Philippines. And so I think, I really just want to honor that movement and really highlight the analysis that they put forth when we're discussing all of these things as well.
Thank you so much, Mac. Thank you, Drew. Thank you, Layla. I want to also let the listeners know to contact your congressperson to tell them that they need to support the Philippines Human Rights Act and to join an organization, whether it's iChirp, Gabriela, the Malaya Movement. Figure out what's your way to contribute, right, to the justice for people in this country, of course, but also it's important to fight for justice for other people around the world. When we know that we, as Americans and people who live in this country, play a role in the oppression of other people. So again, thank you to our guests for sharing this much needed perspective on human rights and international solidarity. I'm your loving host, Dr. Crystal Lee Crane, and this is Us. Thank you for listening to Us, Critical Conversations on the Challenges of Our Time, with me, Dr. Crystal Lee Crane, on TransformationTalkRadio.com. Together, we bring positive change to the world through critical conversations about social justice issues. Tune in every fourth Wednesday of every month at 3 p.m. Pacific with me, Dr. Crystal Lee Crane, and my guests. For more information about Dr. Crystal Lee Crane, please visit crystalleecrane.org and preventionagenda.org. Happy listening.
Views expressed on this program are those of the host, guests, and callers, and do not necessarily reflect the views of the station, its management, or advertisers. You're listening to Transformation Talk Radio.